Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In 2014, a Chinese-backed company, Northwest Innovation Works, announced that it planned to build the world's largest methanol refinery in Kalama, Washington. This methanol would be shipped to China, where it would be processed into olefins to make plastic. The company claims in its latest environmental review that this project would reduce global carbon emissions because it would replace Chinese coal to olefin production with supposedly cleaner gas-based methanol. But today's guest begs to differ. Today we talk with China expert, Washington State University Associate Professor Paul Thiers, about why this analysis is full of holes. Paul, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you.
Well, what was it, about 6 weeks ago, there was a hearing in Longview about the methanol refinery, and lots of people gave testimony, and you got up and gave testimony that was very different from anybody else's approach, which had to do with the marketing, where the markets really were for the supposed methanol-based olefins that the Chinese were planning to make. And after your testimony, I was sitting with some people who were just like nodding their heads and getting really excited, and I just made a beeline, found you, and here you are now. So we probably should talk a little bit about this methanol refinery first and give people who haven't been listening to this show and a lot of other KBOO stuff where we've been covering this for a few years, but to just sort of give some background about what's they're trying to do in Kalama, and then we'll get particularly to your focus on what these real markets are or aren't in China. So first, let's give a little bit of background on the methanol refinery.
Well, methanol is a product that is used in China and other places to produce plastics and for other feedstocks for the chemical industry, petrochemical industry. It can also be used for transportation fuel or other fuel. It can be made from fracked natural gas, which is in huge supply in North America right now, with limited transportation routes to China. As I know you've been reporting on quite a bit, there's all kinds of energy export proposals in the Pacific Northwest. This one is a large, very large plant. The one proposed in Tacoma, as I understand it, is dead. So this is kind of the next one for Northwest NWIW.
Northwest Innovation Works.
Thanks.
An interesting name, as people pointed
out. Yeah, yeah. I think about the kind of the Chinese parent company, so I don't often think about the front company. There is a market in China for all kinds of energy products and fossil fuels. Transportation bottlenecks have been part of the problem with the growth of fossil fuel production in the United States and the U.S. becoming a major exporter again. And this is a community that I think is both the local area as well as the state of Washington is used to the idea of being Pacific Rim export oriented. And so this makes a lot of sense to a lot of powerful stakeholders. And so the question then is, what will be the impacts on the community, on the climate, of going forward with the project?
Well, they can. The shoreline permit, which is one of the main permits that's required by, well, anything that's built along a shoreline, actually, in Washington State. The Columbia Riverkeeper and some other environmental groups basically sued when the shoreline permit was approved, and the shoreline permit board went back to the drawing board, basically, and they agreed that Columbia Riverkeeper and Earth Justice were correct, and they needed to do what's called a life cycle analysis, mm-hmm. which is cradle to grave. So you start with the emissions that would be created at the fracking fields and all the pipeline distribution compressor stations down to the plant itself, emissions there, and then the emissions at the end result in China. And so they had to do a draft supplemental environmental impact statement. That statement came out in, I guess, the end of November, early December, and it really shocked a lot. Well, it didn't shock as many people because there was another very similar draft supplemental environmental impact statement that came out on October 8th for the Tacoma LNG plant that's being proposed. And that also had the same conclusion. So let's talk about the conclusions they drew about greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, so I hadn't actually looked at the Tacoma SEIS, someone in the Southwest Washington community asked me to look at the one for Kalama.
Actually, I'd like to acknowledge who that was.
Don Stanky.
Okay, thank you, Don.
Yeah, and asked me to take a look at it. And I, of course, was primarily looking at the assumptions made about the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the product once it's in China. Although I will say that looking through the whole document, it was clearly it was not a document of high integrity, in my opinion, from the production of the frack gas all the way to its fate in China. But my expertise is on Chinese political economy and energy policy, so that was where I was primarily looking at you know, what would happen to the methanol once it was on its way to China.
So what were some of the problems that you saw with the analysis? And I just kind of give a preview. Next week, we're going to be talking with Pete Erickson with Stockholm Environmental Institute. He'll talk about the front-end issues.
The upstream
issues.
Right.
As well, he'll also probably build on what you're going to be saying now.
Right. Well, so just to stick primarily to the China stuff, because that's what I'm in a position to speak to best. The assumption of Life Cycle Associates who did their argument is that coal is currently and will increasingly be used to produce methanol or to produce olefins for the plastics industry in China. And it is true that China, unlike almost any other country in the world, does use some coal to produce chemicals. That is not how most of those chemicals are produced in China. Most are produced from oil through a process called naphtha cracking, which is a very well-known, long-term, ubiquitous process in China.
Okay, I just want to sort of clarify a few things.
Yeah.
First of all, when you talk about olefins, let's just mention
what this
process is, because most people have probably never heard of olefins.
Yeah, so this is, and I am not an expert in petrochemical chemistry, so I'm not going to go too far in that direction. But essentially, as a feedstock to the petrochemical industry and as a feedstock to plastics, you want to get to a point where you have olefins that you can use then in the chemical process.
So it's that you take the methanol and you turn it into, or the coal and turn it into olefins?
You can do coal to olefins. You can do methanol to olefins. You can also do a process with oil called naphtha cracking or steam cracking, they sometimes call it. And that doesn't actually produce something called olefins, but it can be used in the same same stream.
I actually was in a shop not that long ago after I first heard of olefins, and there was some product that was there, and it was said that this was made of olefin. And I just wonder, is olefin sometimes used on its own before it turns into all these other plastics?
Well, I think so, but again, that's not an area that I really know much about. You know, I've been to a few very modern petrochemical plants in China. I used to work on biofuels quite a bit there. And it is a remarkable set of sort of a menu of ways to get from fossil fuel to the product that you want. So the complexity that has to come out in an environmental impact statement and in a life cycle analysis is what will this product be used for? And just as important as understanding the chemistry is understanding the economics. So what is the cheapest way to produce plastics in China is the real question. And that question is addressed in the environmental impact statement, the supplemental, but it is not addressed correctly. And that's really why I felt I had to kind of come forward.
Okay, I want to talk about what naphtha is, because mm-hmm. I think in people understanding what naphtha is, they may understand why it's so plentiful.
Well, I'm not, again,
it's a byproduct.
It is one way to use oil in the chemical industry, and it's a way to use oil, not for energy, but for production of plastics. And it's very, very common in China. So the point here is that the profitability, the economic calculations in whether to use oil or coal or natural gas as the initial feedstock for getting to the end point of plastics. The argument being made by the company and through the environmental impact statement is that this methanol will displace coal, will replace coal, which of course has a huge greenhouse gas emission footprint. The problem is that that's only accurate if oil is so expensive that the traditional process of naphtha cracking is not going to be used.
Well, I spent a lot of time reading and rereading that life cycle analysis and trying to make sense of it. And then I read a report that the Low Carbon Prosperity Institute, which is actually a subsidiary or whatever, a project of the Washington Business Alliance, and they came up with basically an apology for the DSEIS and explained all the reasons why. And the guy spent a lot of time describing why there was a market for the methanol and why coal was still going to be the prevalent substance that was going to be replaced by the methanol. And I could not make any sense of their logic. And I actually interviewed the guy last week and who wrote that report. And I still can't quite figure out how they get from point A to point B. And I'm wondering, when you read the life cycle analysis, what was your sense of their logic and where did you see the holes going through?
Well, I think that their logic reflects some of the history of the project, which at its present form has to kind of present this idea that natural gas is better than coal. And that's kind of the bedrock. The problem with that, of course, is that the other major fossil fuel used in the chemical industry, oil, also has both greenhouse gas emission implications as well as economic implications. And I feel like the only way to really explain it is that oil is being intentionally left out of the calculations there.
So what would be the difference if it turned out that most of the plastic in China was predominantly being made using naphtha cracking, using oil, as opposed to using coal?
Oh, well, we know that the great majority of the plastics in China are produced using oil. There's no question of that.
But that was not anywhere in the LSA. They were kind of making it like we're replacing 97% coal.
So what they're saying is that as the price of oil skyrocketed, and particularly when it reached its peak in 2012, 2014, that it became profitable to switch to coal to make olefins. And if it became profitable to switch to coal, then coal was going to increasingly be the product used. That period in time did lead to some quite a few new plants being proposed to go from coal to chemicals. And we have some online and some that are in production, though they may have been suspended now because the price of oil has come down. So you don't use coal if oil is below a certain price, and that price can be calculated, and that's what should have been done in the EIS.
Well, it seems like in a lot of cases with that SEIS that they were pulling figures from wherever was most convenient. So the greenhouse or the global warming potential for methane, which is a big issue with the upstream emissions, they pulled a figure from 2007.
Yep.
And it was about 70% or 60% of what the actual figure is, or the latest figure. So it seems like that's true with figuring out the price of oil in the equation.
Well, they didn't even include the price of oil at all. It's not discussed. But the discussion of the prevalence or the coming prevalence of coal to chemicals in China is all the citations are from 2012 to 2014. So in my comments, I put in some additional stuff from 2016, 17, 18, because oil is a little more than half of what it was then. And at that threshold, nobody is going to spend the extra money to use coal to make plastics.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Washington State University Associate Professor and China expert Paul Thiers about flaws in the recent draft Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement for the world's largest methanol refinery that's proposed for Kalama, Washington. Well, let's get a little bit deeper into this, the market stuff. I guess there was also, when I was kind of muddling my way through the life cycle analysis, I was trying to figure out where they were coming up with their market values for stuff. I mean, it's clear that oil wasn't even figured in. But they had all these this reasoning about why methanol was going to be the substance to go with. Mm-hmm. And that they had all these ways of proving that, in fact, the market was that the Kalama methanol was going to become the primary source of methanol and it was going to replace all the other sources of methanol.
Well, I think their argument is not contingent upon current sources of methanol being replaced so much as the idea that methanol demand in China will continue to increase. I think that that's debatable, but it is likely that there will be a market for this methanol. The reason that we can be pretty sure, regardless of what happens with the price of oil, is that methanol can be used as fuel. And in fact, if we go back and look at the original documents from the company, and something as recent as just went up on the web a little while ago about a conference that's going to be held in November, the company has repeatedly mentioned using the methanol for fuel, for transportation fuel in particular. And the reason that's significant is because if it is used for transportation fuel, then the greenhouse gas emissions that can be predicted from this process go way up.
Why is that?
Well, that's because, I like to think of it as a process of taking energy that came from sunlight over, of course, thousands and thousands of years and using it for something. That's what fossil fuel does for us. And in this case, that fossil fuel energy, that energy encapsulated in that, in this case, fracked natural gas, would be released back into the atmosphere whenever it's used as energy to move things around or do other work that, that transportation fuel can do.
So that's different than if it were being used to make plastic.
Well, there's this notion that if it's plastic, and it's not just a notion, it's key to the argument, this the idea that if it's plastic, that somehow the carbon is sort of sequestered. That's a second problem, which I had not pressed in my comments because I wanted to really focus on this economic mistake. But plastics are not landfilled in China. They are primarily incinerated. And plastic incineration for energy, which is done all over urban China, is also going to release the carbon into the atmosphere. So that is a second problem with the SEIS that needs to be recalculated.
Of course, if it were landfilled, there's other issues with that.
There are a lot of issues with plastic being landfilled. There's a lot of issues with plastic going into the ocean. But from the perspective of climate change, and especially short-term greenhouse gas emissions, if the plastic is incinerated, as we know it will be in China, then that's CO2 emissions that are going to add into China's total emissions, and that's going to be because of the plant in Calama.
Well, actually, you were emailing me about that a few days ago, and it just kind of reminded me of, well, stories I've heard of Kathmandu. I haven't been there, but friends of mine who were there maybe in the last 15, 20 years talked about all the plastic that was burned there. And that I got to experience that firsthand in Siem Reap when I was in Cambodia about 14 years ago. And Monday nights were a frightening time. And I vowed I'd never be there on a Monday night again because the streets, and well, this is probably different now because I think it paved more of the streets than they had 14 years ago, but the streets are full of potholes. They fill the potholes with plastic trash, and on Monday night they burned it.
Right.
They weren't using it for energy. They were just like burning it. And there seemed to be this disconnect in Asia because for so many years they wrapped everything in banana leaves and other things that are biodegradable that they didn't seem to understand what it meant to burn plastic. And it was a pretty frightening place, a frightening kind of event to be experiencing. And it feels like what you're describing in China is just a larger scale of what they were doing in Siem Reap.
Well, China went through that period in the 80s and 90s, and I was traveling a lot in China then. So I saw things similar to what you're talking about. In fact, the United States, if you go back to the 30s, home stoves would have incinerators for burning trash. So I think a lot of industrializing societies go through a phase of just burning trash to get rid of it.
And but there's a difference burning trash in the 30s and burning in the United States now, because we weren't burning predominantly like 98% plastic.
Yeah. So the prevalence of plastic in that trash is a real cause for local air pollution. Garbage incineration or municipal waste incineration to energy in China has become, as China has grown economically, has become more sophisticated. There's a range of incinerators, but they are not going to look like just a pile of trash being burned. On the other hand, we have seen a lot of local protest against air pollution caused by incineration. It's very difficult to do environmental protest in China. It's very dangerous. Organizers can get can disappear and then have prison sentences, as well as the lawyers who represent them. You know, an 11-year sentence is not unheard of. So we don't have a lot of kind of uprising about that local air pollution problem. For the SEIS, it's really about the greenhouse gas emissions. So there's many levels of injustice and problems here that we should be thinking about.
Well, actually, one of the proponents of the methanol refinery was accusing the opponents of it of being racist because they didn't care if the Chinese breathed terrible air while we try to clean up our air here in the United States. And actually, mm-hmm. there's been a lot of weird accusations about racism, people who oppose the methanol refinery being anti-Chinese. And it's one of these red herrings, I think, that the proponents of frack gas are kind of throwing out to try to undermine the opposition. But one of the people who testified against the methanol refinery at the Longview hearing did talk about the protests in China around the plastics factories. Are you familiar? Are you at all familiar with what goes on with the kind of pollution that's created by actually manufacturing plastics, let alone incinerating them?
Well, there have been, I usually become aware when there's major protests. Because I'm a political scientist, I'm mostly interested in what's happening in terms of the political system. So we have thousands of protests every year in China, both rural and urban. And they are often targeted at every step of the industrialization process, from the conversion of farmland into industrial processes, including coal power plants and petrochemical plants. And in urban areas that have large petrochemical industries and storage, we've had protests usually following major accidents. One of the most famous in Dalian, China, after a storm, I think it was a PX plant.
But what's PX?
Oh, it's a... Again, I'm not a chemist, so I don't want to characterize it.
You need to keep a chemist in your
way.
Back pocket.
It's
right?
It's a product of industrial chemistry, and it's been associated with a lot of health risks. Typically, in China, the government, when faced with a large uprising, will make promises, identify organizers. Take the organizers out of the equation. I mean, it's an authoritarian dictatorship. And then whether or not the promises are kept, that that PX plant in Dalian is still operating, even though it was promised that it would be closed. You know, it's just very different than the environmental justice movement we know here. And I am sensitive to the idea that we have to think about whether China bashing is in any way sort of racially tinged or something, because of course there's a horrible Cold War history with that. But I also think it's worth remembering that in a truly authoritarian dictatorship in which over a million people are currently incarcerated without trial, staging an environmental protest is a whole different exercise than our decisions about, well, should we get a permit, shouldn't we? And I'm not belittling the work of people here. It's tremendously important, but you're in a different political environment to try and do it there. If this methanol goes to China, there will be environmental consequences, not just for the climate, but also for local people, and that will be imposed in a way on a system in which their ability to push back and their ability to protect themselves is much less than ours.
Yeah, I felt like that was something that was that was one of the charges that kept coming out during that hearing by the proponents. But, I mean, there was an awful lot of, you people don't care about China and you're anti-Chinese.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
and I heard from people in Kalama, I mean, they've been accused of all kinds of stuff. This is going on for the last few years about just if they're opposed to this project because it's run by a Chinese company. At the same time that Northwest Innovation Works is always claiming to be a Northwest-based company. And I was at a luncheon meeting with NWIW people about a week before the hearing. And one of the opponents talked about your boss, your mm-hmm. president, has said that this is going to be, that this methanol could be used for transportation fuel. And the two NWIW people there were like, oh, he's not our boss. So what is the relationship between NWIW and the Chinese government?
Okay. So there's a thing called the Chinese Academy of Sciences. Probably the best way of thinking about it would be if the National Institute of Health grew massively and also was embedded in an authoritarian dictatorship. It's sort of a spin-off. It's a research-oriented thing. Hundreds of thousands of people work there it's in Beijing and Shanghai. They have a holding company for their spinoff efforts because they also, of course, you know, China is a state capitalist system. You can make a lot of money by being associated with the state while you compete in the market. So the Chinese Academy of Sciences has a spinoff umbrella thing called the CAS Holding Incorporated. It's capitalized at something like $6 billion U.S. dollars. They have a lot of ventures in everything from aerospace to genetic engineering, but they have one company that they have spun off that operates outside of China, and that is NWIW.
So do you know much about the history of NWIW?
Well, it was, I mean, you can see that BP was interested in this methanol plant and had started, I think they actually got to the point of starting permit processes and so on. They sold everything they had to CAS Holdings. It's actually a subsidiary company called Bika, Shanghai Bika Clean Energy Technologies or something like that. The joint venture that controls NWIW is that Shanghai Bika company, a company from Hong Kong, which is Legacy BP, and then as I understand, a marketing arm, which is also from Hong Kong, but is actually also owned by members of the board of directors of Chinese Academy of Sciences. So it's pretty much entirely, I mean, clearly majority and pretty much entirely a Chinese state company. It characterizes itself as a Chinese state company in Chinese language documents.
So what is NWIW's actual relationship
so
to it?
So NWIW, as I understand it, is a foreign subsidiary of Shanghai Bika, which is a subsidiary of CAS Holdings Incorporated, Chinese Academy of Sciences Holdings.
So when representatives of NWIW claim that this, I can't remember the guy, name of the guy who's the president of CA.
Well, there's Jiang Mianhong is kind of he's the political backup. He's the son of Jiang Zemin, who is still the longest serving general secretary of the Communist Party since Deng Xiaoping. So he's very, very highly politically connected. So are they saying that he's not their CEO?
Basically what they seem to be acting is we're really independent. We're really our own company, and really V. Gottlieb is our CEO.
Yeah, I think that you can document a company a number of ways, but I would say that they are a foreign they're a controlled foreign entity of the Chinese party state.
Now, the other thing is interesting, they also have some high connections in terms of Northwest politics.
Yeah, so Jiang Mianhong, as I mentioned, is the son of Jiang Zemin, a very, very powerful, you know, one of the 100 most powerful people in China, certainly. He was managing a bunch of stuff in the Chinese aerospace industry. He's a former vice president of Chinese Academy of Sciences. It's sort of like his official highest ranking job. And at that time, Gary Locke was ambassador to China, former governor of Washington. I don't know what, you know, ideas they made together and promises they made to each other, but I think that Gary Locke's involvement in this plant, it's also indicative of this idea that somehow natural gas is this bridge fuel. And in fact, the BP company that that CAS bought is called Double Green Bridge. All of this is a reference to this idea that somehow natural gas is a renewable green energy source that's going to get us to where we need to go. And I can imagine Gary Locke and the some of the people in the tech industries in China having lots of conversations about how, yeah, this would be great business to bring to Washington State.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Washington State University Associate Professor and China expert Paul Thiers. And we're talking about the flaws in the recent draft supplemental environmental impact statement for the world's largest methanol refinery proposed in Calama, and also kind of the larger Chinese connection to this push to export frack gas, mainly in this region being produced mainly in British Columbia and Alberta, to Asia and a lot to China. So there's been, people have been trying for 14, 15 years now to get these gas facilities going so we could continue, as you're describing, this kind of Pacific Rim connection between the eastern part of the Pacific Rim here and the western part in Asia. It's interesting to look at the role that Gary Locke played, but it seems like there's some other Washington politicians who also are connected. I'm not sure if Gary Locke is the linchpin to it.
I would be surprised if Gary Locke and his connections to the Chinese elite is not the original, sort of the origin of this particular project. But, I mean, we can go back and see that many of these projects, both in Oregon and Washington, when they were originally starting to be penciled in, particularly LNG, the idea was import. And this was before, you know, the fracking explosion sort of made it clear that the United States was going to become an energy exporter, as well as the development of the tar sands in Canada and the potential for tar sands in Utah and places like that. So we've seen, if we look long-term, a real transition to the idea of energy imports, particularly liquefied natural gas imports, these facilities now being put forward for export. Some people would say that was always the plan, but I don't know.
Well, actually, I talked a lot to Dan Sears, the Columbia Riverkeeper, about the Oregon LNG proposals. Mm-hmm. There were
Astoria.
It's about seven or 15. I don't know. Right. There are lots of proposals to build LNG facilities in Astoria, and he started working with the people in Astoria to help them organize when he first came to Columbia Riverkeeper. And he was talking to these old-timers, landowners who lived along this proposed pipeline route that was going to be bringing the... it was actually going to be supposedly piping the LNG that was received in Warrenton and in Bradford Landing and shipping it inland on this pipeline that so far hasn't gotten built. And he said that very early on in the process, these people who were very savvy, and I don't know how they knew this stuff. I mean, some of them might have actually worked in the energy industry, and they're saying, this isn't import, this is export. And they they were saying that to him maybe a year into the project. And soon enough, it all came out. So it's kind of interesting that it seemed a lot of people thought that a lot of these things are all switch and bait, that they start them as imports so they can get a foothold, and then the intention all along has been to be export.
Yeah, well, of course, again, going back, not just the politics of the Cold War, but the politics of the oil crisis and all of that, being able to argue that you were contributing to U.S. energy security has always been an important foot in the door. Yeah, it is really flipped completely around now. And the real question is, fossil fuels exploited in inland North America, the United States and Canada, how do you get them to the Asian market? And this idea that the people of China need this product is contingent on the idea that they need more plastic or that they need more emissions from fossil fuels. And I've been traveling in China since 1984. I feel a really strong commitment to it. I'm fluent in Mandarin. I don't think that I would agree with that. One of the things that I found interesting was looking at the plastic content of municipal waste that's incinerated. It's highest in Guangzhou, which is far southern China, where the production for products for export really took off and is centered. So, you know, we're talking about plastics that's going to wrap something up that you buy at Costco.
And this is the thing this was another thing that was really striking me during the hearings. And I heard this every time I've heard people arguing for the methanol refinery. They talk about how this plastic is necessary. He said, we might want to, you know, be using less plastic, but this plastic is going to be produced in China, will be in your cell phone, will be in your car, will be in your computer, will be in medical equipment. And I'm thinking, and disposable plastic bags and straws and all the other packaging stuff. And they don't talk about that at all. I'm kind of curious, do we know where this plastic would be going and how much of it would be in my car and how much of it would be in the straw I'm refusing to use?
So CAS Holdings says that they have I'm not sure if they've used the word contracts. I'll have to go back and look at the Chinese. But they say that they have customers for the olefins that would be produced. I don't know of any statement that they've made or anybody else that would allow us to actually say, oh, this factory or this this product. You know, because of course there's a lot of different plastics and there's a lot of different other things that come out of the petrochemical industry. So I think the volume of plastic incinerated in China is accelerating rapidly. We know that. And the amount of plastics associated with Chinese exports is also very, very high. So we can just make some assumptions based on that.
I saw like the list of the types of plastics, basically, mm-hmm. whether it's propylene. I'm not a chemical engineer either, so I don't really know all this stuff. But when I looked at it, the little that I know about what the source material, what source plastics go into what, it looked to me like it was everything from maybe a dashboard for a car to disposable plastic bag. I mean, I didn't see any kind of plastic that was not on that list.
Right.
So what does it say to you when they keep arguing in favor of a methanol refinery that we need these plastics, we're not going to do it, we can't live without these plastics, and they completely disregard all the disposable plastics that we could easily live without?
Well, I think, I guess, I always fall back to political economy. And the real question is, what costs are being externalized? What would the cost of plastics be if that was not externalized? You know, if you forced it in through some sort of pricing, taxes, pollution permits, the cost would go up and we know we would use less. And what that means is there's what we call elasticity, which means you don't need it.
Well, actually, a friend of mine talks about how when it becomes plastic, I mean, you have a resource like frack gas, which has all kinds of potential. But once you turn it into plastic, she says, it's worthless because the plastic has no value. I guess except as a carbon sink.
We could think of it as a carbon sequestration program, not the best. But I think the one piece that Americans probably don't capture, I'd have to look and see if Spokane is burning any plastic. They have an incinerator there, but most Americans probably don't recognize the very high energy potential in plastic. So once it's out of the ground, even if it spends some time in a landfill, I think eventually somebody's going to want to burn it to get the energy out of it.
But is that what we want to be doing?
No, of course not. I mean, that's what that means is once it's out of the ground, it's going to go to the atmosphere. It may spend some time even in the ocean, but it's going to go to the atmosphere.
And everywhere it leaves a trail of disaster.
Yep.
Yeah, and then it's in our bodies.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this argument that somehow there is some benefit to the Chinese people of taking natural gas from the inland North America and transporting it to them, the market forces will benefit, but I don't see many people in China benefiting from that.
Well, another thing that's kind of interesting, we've been people on in the environmental side of things have been saying for years. Well, for instance, Sightline Institute talks about the thin green line here mm-hmm. in the Northwest, which is our ability to block these exporting the massive amounts of fossil fuels that are being dug up in the interior West and shipping them through here. And this is the place where we can stop it. And if we can stop it from being shipped out, then we can eventually stop it from being dug up. But and I've heard a lot of people talking about how this is basically the push to build these export facilities is to get the frack gas out of the ground before it totally loses its value, because we've got so much of it. And actually, last week there was a story on Oregon Public Broadcasting about Jordan Cove, and mm-hmm. they quoted Pemba as saying that this export facility in Coos Bay is necessary to export all this gas that's being produced in Wyoming and Colorado that has no way to get anyplace else. I mean, they're basically saying the same thing that Columbia Riverkeeper or Sightline would be saying. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't have the negative spin on that. But I thought it's kind of interesting in a way that they are admitting that we don't know what to do with this stuff if we can't export it.
Well, European markets are are not going to increase. I mean, the Asian market, and particularly the Chinese market, is the market, right? And that would be for coal exports, natural gas exports, oil exports. China and the East Asian economic system that surrounds it is the market. So that does put the Pacific Northwest, and I would make sure people include British Columbia in that, obviously all the way down to Coos Bay.
And all the way up to Kitimat.
Yep.
Where they want to put an LNG facility.
Right. So the alternatives to moving through the Pacific Northwest are not economically attractive. They're not attractive from a regulatory and permit perspective. I think the assumption in some planners' minds is that, you know, coastal Pacific Northwest is not a rich part of the country, and that, you know, the promise of jobs, the promise of capital will overcome any sort of environmentalist's normative instincts. And that's really where we are right now is, and, you know, it breaks my heart to see the labor unions split on this and so on. And that's really where our part of the country, our part of the world is right now, is that question about whether or not the temptation of capital and the temptation of jobs can leverage a poor area of the country into making what I think will be some really regrettable decisions.
Well, but so far we've seen all the coal terminals go down in flames, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And oil doesn't look like it's going to be going through this region either, because the North America's largest oil by rail terminal was put to rest, put out of its misery in Vancouver last year. It's just the thing that's left now is frack gas.
Well, Barbara, I just would also, though, I think we need to recognize the importance of what we call sunk costs. So, you know, all of those LNG terminals were never going to be built. The importance was, could they get one built? Once you get one built, you're going to use it. It's a huge upfront cost. And I think it's the same with this. So Tacoma may be gone, but they really only need to hit one of these huge plants. So I guess what I'm saying is it's a battle you have to win over and over and over again.
I think that I've been looking at a lot and thinking about in the last few months is the difference between fighting oil and coal, which a lot of the people who are proponents of the frack gas stuff will claim at least that they oppose Millennium Coal, mm-hmm. though I think a lot of them are lying from what I've been told by people in Longview and in Kalama. But it's now fashionable to say I'm against oil and coal, mm-hmm. but natural gas is the answer. And you were mentioning a little bit earlier that it's seen as it's being sold as a bridge fuel. So how do we dispel that mythology?
Well, I think first by really insisting that these calculations be done correctly. So is it in fact going to displace coal? I think we can pretty clearly indicate that it's not, at least not universally, going to displace coal. It's going to displace oil, and it's going to just be additional energy, right? But I think the other thing, when we think about a bridge, maybe we should ask how long the bridge is, because if you're building a plant like this, you're building a plant with the assumption that it's going to operate for 20 years. So are we going to be in an entirely fossil fuel-based economy 20 years from now? For people who sell themselves as the green alternative to say, and we will still be the green alternative, the not-so-green alternative 20 or more years from now, is a pretty ungreen statement given where we are on climate change.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today, we're talking with Washington State University Associate Professor and China expert Paul Thiers. We're talking about the methanol refinery that's being proposed for Kalama and a lot of the fallacies that are being used to support why it's needed and just looking at why it's probably not needed. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the Chinese connection, because one of the concerns that people are talking about is it's trying to figure out how is NWIW financed? Mm-hmm. Why are they going after federal grants and state grants and looking for all kinds of tax breaks? And where do you think their money is coming from? And if they don't, and they're not so far not getting the grants and the tax breaks that they're looking for. So how would they continue to proceed financially?
Right. So there's an immediate answer that's not entirely clear, and then a broader answer that I hope we can touch on a little bit. Chinese Academy of Sciences Holdings Incorporated is, as I mentioned, it's a heavily capitalized holding company for spinoffs from the Chinese Academy of Sciences, for for-profit spinoffs. I think they're at about $6 billion, U.S. dollars. So they have obviously got working capital. And as I say, as far as I know, this is their only large foreign venture. They are raising capital for this project. Obviously, you would rather have a government subsidy if you can. But a big conference in November of this year, which is a conference for venture capital in Beijing, the specific CEO, the chairman of the board of CAS Holdings, a guy named Wu Lebin. He is going to be speaking at that conference, and the description of him, which also describes the company, to attract capital, says that this will be used both for plastics and for transportation. So they're selling it to the international capital in a different way than they're selling it to the SEIS. So they can raise capital by showing that they're going to be profitable, but through the what we call the Houtai, the political figure that solidifies this state company, Jiang Zemin's son, they can have access to a lot of capital from the Bank of China, leveraged through the Communist Party. So I think that it's more likely, if subsidies don't come from the U.S. government and if capital doesn't come from Europe and other places, that they will be offering the community Chinese loans.
And then what does that mean to the company, to the community?
So this is consistent with a big initiative that China is taking into Central Asia, Africa, Eastern Europe, called the Belt and Road Initiative, the One Belt, One Road Initiative. And people can do a little research on that. You'll see recently documentation of what it's meant for the port of Mombasa in Kenya. The Malaysians very early on said, we want no part of this. But, you know, Myanmar, the Seychelles, they're all going through a process of this is an effort to build a Chinese controlled infrastructure, ports, pipelines, in some cases refineries and other energy facilities, across Asia and Africa into Europe. And so, you know, Longview is not normally presented as part of One Belt, One Road, but I think the pattern that we see there that can help us think about what this would mean to the Pacific Northwest is one of a large amount of capital being brought in to underwrite large infrastructure projects. It comes in the form of loans, and if there's an inability to repay the loans, then there's control issues over the infrastructure itself. Now, whether that would mean that the port would eventually become more Chinese controlled, I think is, you know, it sounds alarmist, but I think it is something that people should be very, very conscious of happening in other parts of the world.
Well, I was talking to a guy from Kalama last year, and he believes that the methanol refinery is really just a ploy on the part of the Chinese government to get a military beachhead on the Columbia River. And at the time, I thought, it sounds a little bit...
Again, I think we have a Cold War history with China that is really problematic. And I think that, and of course... the Chinese military is expanding into the what they call the South China Sea, of course. But I think the real issues here are economic dependency. And so China now makes more loans to Africa than the World Bank does. And if we think about the history of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and how loans were used to leverage structural adjustment. I think that's a much clearer blueprint for what the Chinese party state would be able to do in areas that are heavily indebted to them.
So if we could get the unions in Longview and Kalama to take a look at Kenya and ask them, do you want to be Kalama in Kenya?
China is going to control a major part of the port there. And that's because of how the debt structure was put in place. I don't think we're really used to thinking of our part of the world as kind of using dependency theory to kind of think about our vulnerability to global capital. This is a different kind of global capital, and to be absolutely honest, I'd rather have BP. I'd rather have Shell.
Well, I was thinking about years ago. I was driving around in a part of Clackamas County that I'd lived in, actually between Sandy and Estacada, and there's a lot of forest land there that it was owned by Publishers Papers, and it was very carefully logged in those days when I was living out there. I was driving through there maybe 15 years later, sometime in the 80s, and the Publishers Papers name was gone. There was a Japanese company, I couldn't mm-hmm. recognize the name, who owned the mill and I guess all the land, and it was just being clear cut like crazy. And it gave me this creepy feeling. I thought, it's funny, that was the heyday of Japan. I was thinking, oh, great, we are now a colony of Japan, and they're taking all our wood, which was actually happening to some degree in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I think that that's on a very small scale what could be happening mm-hmm. in our economic relationship with China through the ports.
Yeah, and I also think it's important to distinguish foreign direct investment has a lot of complexity to it. Debt is a particularly strong way that that capital moves through a community. So if the Chinese want to build a pipeline and own it, then we'll have a politics about that, and that would be, pretty interesting. But if they want to lend money to communities to build pipelines and plants and then have a whole structure that falls into place if those debts can't be repaid, and that's how control takes place. That's a little different than direct investment. I'm not saying direct investment isn't problematic, but I do worry about large amounts of Chinese capital being brought into this thin green line issue.
So how do we build another parallel wall that has to do with the economics?
I think the United States Congress has the ability to hold hearings and find out more about ownership. We have antitrust law. We have regulatory structures that we can mobilize, political and regulatory structures that we can mobilize. But none of that is going to happen unless the community really, really demands it. The first order of business, though, is this SEIS and the shoreline, all that permit stuff. But I think it's also not too early to be in talking about the bigger background issues of foreign capital and control.
Well, one last argument that the proponents of methanol were making is that it was best to build this big facility in a place that has the toughest environmental regulations in the world. And what would you say to that?
I think the toughest regulatory, the toughest environmental regulations in the world are the surface of the earth with natural gas under it. that's how you know you're not going to get fugitive emissions. You're not going to get what we call boundary leakage, all this stuff. Once you extract this material, you've put it into a political and economic environment that you don't control well. We do have better regulatory environment than China. But that doesn't really mean that it's as good as leaving it in the ground.
Well, it strikes me that the regulatory environment in Oregon and Washington, but I'm particularly seeing it in Washington right now, is the regulations on the books are just fine. It's the politics behind it, and the fact that much of the political establishment is either being quiet or neutral on Jordan Cove and, mm-hmm. and Clema Methanol and Tacoma LNG, or it's actually being actively in support of it.
Yeah, it's important to recognize not only Gary Locke's role, but Jay Inslee endorsed this project.
He's backed off. Now he's neutral.
But these are, you know, these are our Democratic leaders with strong climate change language in their campaigns and everything else. It's very tempting to try and say there is some sort of, bridge through natural gas to get where we want to be. And in the meantime, these companies can make a whole lot of money.
Well, I was in a seminar down at USC about 15 years ago, and there was a discussion about bridge fuels at that time, and the argument was between natural gas and nuclear power. But back in 2002, natural gas was not seen, was not understood to have all the dangers that it has now. So I feel like that bridge closed probably in 2002, and it's time to look at a new bridge, which would be renewables.
Yep. I think natural gas is very different than the coal industry, and in a lot of ways it's even different than oil. But one of the things that's common is that it is a very economically powerful juggernaut right now. And so it's going to find language to shield itself.
So we just have to get on top of that language. Yeah. I'll also remind listeners that Gary Locke's birthday is a week from tomorrow, and there's going to be a gathering at the state capitol in Olympia to wish him a happy birthday, bring cupcakes, and no LNG and no methanol signs. So, and it starts at 11. Well, I want to thank you, Paul, for joining us. It's been very interesting talking to you, and I hope we continue this conversation.
Thank you, Barbara.
We've been talking with Washington State University Associate Professor Paul Thiers today, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk more about the fallacies of frack gas with Pete Erickson, who's with the Stockholm Environmental Institute. My engineer is Patsy Kullberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Cassandra Wilson. Thanks for listening.
Think about the life I live, a figure made of clay. Think about the things I lost, the things I gave away. When I'm in a certain mood, I search the halls and look. One night I found these magic.